It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, Lorenzo Sandoval is the artistic director and executive producer of the Iowa Shakespeare Experience. But today we're going to talk about what it was like to grow up as a Hispanic kid in the Quad Cities and what it means to be other. But first, the Weepies are here. Deb Talon and Steve Tannen have been making music together for 15 years. You probably won't hear them on Top 40 radio, but you have probably heard their music featured on popular TV shows, even in campaign ads for President Barack Obama in 2008. They're a prolific band when it comes to writing songs and recording, but fans rarely get a chance to see them live for a number of reasons. They'll be playing at the Englert in Iowa City on Saturday, November 26th at 8 p.m., completely acoustic and alone. And here's a little taste of their music from their most recent album, Sirens. It's called No Trouble.
Here lie remains of a ship that sailed too close to the storm, capsized, grounded, washed up, sounded. I hear their voices, sirens singing in the street. I thought they might be calling out for you, for me. I hear their voices, sirens calling out emergency.
That's just a little taste of Sirens, actually, the title track off of the album Sirens. And as I said, the Weepies are here with me now. Deb Talon, hello, welcome.
Hello, thanks for having us.
And Steve Tannen, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us. We are big fans of your show.
Oh, likewise. I'm big fans of yours as well. And listening to that track, Sirens, we'll talk more about some of the experiences you guys have been through in recent years. But I know that that entire album, and specifically that track, was recorded during a difficult time in your lives.
Yeah.
You guys, you have three kids, and when you were recording this, you had a newborn. And Deb, you were diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer.
I was indeed. Yeah.
So living through that, you had, I'm sure, so much that you needed to do to keep going with three young kids and dealing with your treatment and your health. What did continuing to make your music do for you during that time?
It was kind of a through line to life and not illness and not scary things. It felt generative, you know, in this time where I felt like my body was breaking down. And we have three young kids who are, whatever's going on, just so full of life. And it was a really difficult time. And I think that there's a gravitas to the whole record because of that. We hear it anyway when we listen back, which we don't do very much, partly because it was such a difficult time. But we feel really proud about the what we created during that time. And I got well.
So. Well, and Steve, looking at your face, and you were listening to that track, as Deb just said, you don't listen to it.
I haven't listened to that track literally since we mixed it, and I didn't even mix that, so probably since we recorded it, and I can hear the room that we were in. That was while Deb had chemo, and we didn't know what was going to happen, and she was extraordinarily tired that week, and just impossible to live with because she was like, I'm getting into the studio today, and she couldn't get up, so I helped her up the stairs, and we got one take, and that was that take, and it brought me right back there. And I think that that force of will is what got Deb through. I really do. Deb's ability to say, this is what I'm doing with my life. whatever's happening.
Well, and your support through it, you know, it was a team effort. It was very much a team effort. And yeah, I mean, I was determined. There was an element of put your head down and go through it. You know, there's not really much else to do.
Listening to that track, I mean, you say she did it in one take. I mean, your voice is so beautiful, but it doesn't sound any different from your voice on all these other tracks, you know, these songs that you recorded when you were healthy and strong. And I think about all of the things that you were going through physically, having your voice, something that defines you. Was that part of wanting to record that day, to have that part of you that maybe was untouched?
That's a nice encapsulation. Yeah, I think so. I think so, because in that role or in that part of myself, yeah, there was nothing unhealthy. And I just remember hearing that little bit. I remember the feeling of, like, really feeling each note a little bit differently or more, maybe more. There was a little bit more of a weight to each thing. So I kind of enjoyed it also, you know, singing during that time when I could.
Usually when I hear our songs back, I can hear nothing but mistakes. Just like, and I talk to animators who are the same way, and they'll point out, and you look, you're like, oh, I guess that's true. And that's mostly why I don't listen to our music. But right there, it wasn't. I just heard, I actually just projected all the way back to where we were. And that feels good. Dude, play it again. Play it again.
Well, we will play more music as the hour goes on. But we've kind of started not at the end of your story, because clearly there's a whole lot more story to go. But let's go back to the beginning of your story, because you may have one of the cutest, sweetest origin stories in all of music. So, Steve, why don't you start us? Let's take us back to the night you guys met.
Oh, well, let me take you back just a little before that.
Okay.
Because I was trying to be brave enough to be a songwriter in New York, but I was basically drinking late into the night and playing with in dive bars at 11 p.m., and that started to work. I started to have a very bad career that was really fun. And I heard a record from a songwriter in Boston who was sort of the up-and-coming songwriter named Deb Talon, and I became obsessed with it. And then I went to play a show in Boston, and Deb Talon came to the show. And in the crowd, there was one person in a red dress surrounded by her posse, and I was completely intimidated. And we met, and then Deb ran away. She ran out of the room, and she emailed me and said, I'm going to be in New York playing so-and-so. So I got all my friends together, and we went down. We saw Deb Talon, and all of my friends turned to me, and I had eight of them, and seven of them asked if they could date Deb Talon, if I was dating. And I said, and I didn't even know Deb Talon. I said, no, you can't date Deb Talon. Of course not. And I was very taken with her music. And we started writing that night. We hung out after the show.
And it was just instant musical chemistry, but instant personal chemistry,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, all of it was sort of wrapped in together. But we started on sort of musical footing, I would say. And there was this, you know, Steve tells his side. My side was very similar. I was sort of introduced to his record by someone who was kind of within the Boston music community. And that night I wrote that he was, when he was performing, on a little business card that I think I still have, February 11th. I started listening to the record and I couldn't stop. And I was very uncomfortable with how obsessed I was getting. And my roommate, luckily, also loved his music. So, and she's very, very tall. She was one of the people in the audience, I'm sure you saw, my roommate Anne. And, yeah, I definitely went with a protective posse.
They all dressed in black. It was so intimidating. It was my first experience with, like, there are people who just are protective of Deb Talon, even if they know her or don't know it. And it's true. And I'm one of them now. But at the time, it was very intimidating to see. And
because they all just love her so much?
I don't know. There's an openness to Deb's music that leads that way. I believe that. And I mean, I feel the same way about other artists that I love as well. Do you know what I mean? You're protective of them.
Yeah.
And around here, don't ever talk about Kurt Vonnegut in a bad way. Do you know what I mean? You will be just taken down on the streets of Iowa City. And so I think it's a similar thing.
So when you started making music together, I mean, clearly...
That night.
Yeah, that night. So that quickly.
Well, she couldn't... I don't know. I've never asked you if this is true or not.
What?
She couldn't find the place she was supposed to stay.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, but I worked it.
So I said, I have a couch. And I made it very clear that there was a couch. And I was illegally subletting this place that had a couch. And so it was big enough to have a couch and a bed. But we sat up all night drinking wine and playing songs for each other, mostly older. And then as we got the wine bottle ran out, we got more and more into songs that we were just finishing and half-finished songs. And we started suggesting how to fix them to each other. And it felt very natural and completely strange. And then we went to breakfast, I think. And that was the beginning. And we stayed in touch. It took about a year for us to decide to tour together. And then eventually I told no one else to date her. Like, in general, no one else.
Ever. Well, and you guys have been making music together now for 15 years. And we're going to take a short break here. We're going to listen to some more of your music. We're going to listen to that track that I mentioned earlier, No Trouble, off of Sirens, your most recent album. Of course, I want to mention again that you're going to be performing in Iowa City, a pretty rare show for the Weepies, coming up on Saturday, November 26th at 8 p.m. The Weepies are with me today, Deb Talon and Steve Tannen.
Sometimes trouble needs me, don't need no trouble. But it's plain to see, sometimes trouble needs me. A couple of my friends are a couple in divorce. They dress me on my right and I say, oh yes, of course. Love is not a law anybody can enforce. Anybody can enforce.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour, the Weepies, Steve Tannen and Deb Talon. They are an indie band based in Iowa City these days, and they released their newest album a little while back. It's called Sirens, and they're going to be performing at the Englert Theater in Iowa City on Saturday, November 26th at 8 p.m., completely acoustic and alone. So we talked about when you guys first got together and started making music together. And, all right, I use the word indie, although some people describe you as folk. And clearly you were never trying to jump into the crazy pop music business in the United States. But as you started making music together, Deb, and you were creating something and creating a new sound and falling in love with each other's voices and so many other things, how did you begin to conceive of what you were making together?
Well, it happened sort of by accident a little bit. I mean, we were both sort of helping each other finish solo, quote-unquote, records when we met. And then because we were just hanging out so much together and we both write all the time, we started writing together. And then we were going to have a joint show. And our friend who runs
culturally important.
Culturally important folk club. I'm like, infamous? No, that's not right. folk club called Club Passim in Boston. He said, well, we'll call the show Deb Talon and Steve Tannen. And we were like, no, that's not. He's, well, we'll come up with something else. And so we spent about a week, like, tossing names around.
We were almost the Weeds. We were almost the Full Catastrophe. We were almost a whole bunch of stuff. And jokingly, Deb, or somebody, I don't know, I would say who, had a breakdown and just started crying about it. And we said, oh, we should be the Weepies, ha ha. And then we told Matt that, and he laughed. And I didn't know that the issue was settled. but it was
but
settled.
It was.
So you continued working to name yourselves when you'd really already done it.
Well, it went out there, and then so that social show sold out, and then the next one, they added a second show, and that sold out. And then we thought, well, we'll put out a record. What will we call it? Ha ha, the Weepies. And then here we are. You know what I mean? And it was, we were reading the biography of the Wailers. And so it was sort of, Bob Marley said, well, we all start out crying, so we're all Wailers. And I thought, well, except we're sort of the gentler folk version of that, so we're the Weepies. So. And it was also our name for people we could go see Pinocchio with, and they wouldn't care that we were crying, sobbing uncontrollably, or that we'd leave the room when Monstro would come in.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what really was your first breakthrough song. This is World Spins Madly On.
I woke up and wished that I was dead, with an aching in my head. I lay motionless in bed. I thought of you and where you'd gone. Let the world spin madly on. And everything that I said I'd do, like make the world brand new and take the time for you, I just got lost and slept right through the dawn. And the world spins madly on.
Just a little bit of The World Spins Madly On by The Weepies. And now when I say that, that was your first song to really break through. In reading interviews that you guys have done in the past, it sounds like you were fairly surprised by the success of this song. How did that happen, and how did you find out about it?
Okay, so the record sold 238 copies the first week. And then 3 months later, it was the number one song on the folk charts of 8 countries, including America.
Wow.
And it made it into and it was on the strength, essentially, of people sharing that song. I didn't want it on the record because it was my voice. Most things, I love Deb's voice. Mine is fine. I have a fine voice, but I tend not to want
it. Emotional voice.
But Deb and I, the moment you do something called mastering, right before you put the record out, where you make all the levels even and you make all the tracks into one record. And the night before mastering, we were in a hotel, this, you know, roadside hotel somewhere. And I said, it's not going on the record. And Deb said, can I remix it right now on the laptop? And I said, go ahead. And I went out for a walk and Deb remixed it like that. And I thought, okay, that's pretty good. We'll put it last, put it 10th or 11th. And then we got in the studio and the engineer and Deb ganged up on me and they put it there. And then the record company put it out. And that's really, is that fair?
Yeah. And I would say, yeah, we were very surprised at how it sort of caught. I think that's something you just, you put, for us, I'll speak for us, and I think for many of our comrades, you put out music that you feel. You know, you write songs that you feel, you produce them in a way that is feelingful, you put them out in the world, and, we have songs that are particularly personally resonant, but there's no saying what other people will sort of what will resonate in their own lives. And I feel really fortunate. I think we had this one song that sort of took us into a different level career-wise, and then there are many songs that people have sort of taken into their lives, and it feels really lucky that way. So, like, that song sort of...
Right. It wasn't a hit. It wasn't like Loser by Beck or Hey Ya. It was just suddenly people took notice and then embraced all these other songs as well. But there was no question what led the charge.
Yeah.
And then all these other ones were able to get in to people's lives.
Well, and speaking of people connecting with songs, we got this email from Jim in Dubuque. He said, I just want to thank them for making the song World Spins Madly On. It helped me through hard times, and it's been going through my head since last Wednesday. And now, after this song kind of hit, and you guys kind of hit, it sounds like you kind of freaked out about that. And you went off to live in a shack in the hills in California?
We did.
Well, we did. Yeah. Hold on, though. We did a year of our car, coffee houses, 180 shows in like 190 days, where we were at festivals in Europe and everywhere. And then we were just exhausted. And we are recluses. This is very unusual for us to come and talk on the radio. Like, I can talk your ear off, but privately, in a bar.
Yeah, we're good one-on-one.
Yeah, we freaked out. And we rented this place on the State Park in California, an hour outside of L.A., with, like, no heat, with a Ben Franklin stove and coyotes.
And lots of spiders.
And, oh, my God. Yeah, a lot of spiders.
You guys do good research.
Yeah.
No, that house had it was a colony of black widow spiders that went a half a mile into the park and ended right in our garage. And then underneath the bedroom were was rattlesnakes. Really?
Yeah.
I'm not making this up. And there were brown recluses in the wood pile, but you deal with that. That's no big deal. I was like, okay, shake them off. And that's why when we started having children, we left that.
Yeah,
place.
But for that time, it was a real refuge. And, I think we did run away a little bit, partly in order to make our next record and not feel like we had something to prove, just to sort of get a little bit of a cave where we could just sort of do what we do. And, we would dart into L.A. and into the stuff that was going on and to see friends. But we really spent a lot of time holed up. And then I got pregnant and couldn't move. So I filled the shack, and then we got the baby out, and then we moved.
No, I was just going to – you just sent me back there. I remember not going to movie premieres. Do
you
remember that?
Like actively not.
Because we were starting to get our songs in movies, and people we admired and would be like, come to the movie premiere. And we'd be like, no. I can't. We can't. And so we would be like, sorry, I don't know, there's a mudslide or something. We just never went.
But you did jump into that life in L.A. And I can't help but point out that you live in Iowa City now.
Yeah.
Did you run away again?
No, this felt more like a running two to me. I mean, it felt like, we had two kids. We started looking outside L.A. It was so expensive and so crazy. And we had really embraced the crazy for a bunch of years. And then we just were like, I think we need to at least try to feel what it feels like to be outside. And then I got pregnant again. We were like, okay, there's some pressure on now finding some place.
Well, we're vagabonds, and we wanted to put roots down somewhere. And every time we'd been through Iowa, we would say to each other, this is amazing. We should buy a house here and have a bunch of kids. And we would, and then we would like sober up in the morning and we'd have to be in Chicago or wherever the next show was, and we would sort of move on. And this time we were like, we're doing this. We're gonna, and we did. It was surprisingly easy.
It really was.
If you want to change your life, seriously, and that thing is in the back of your mind, do it. And it's been great. So welcoming, so exactly the positives that we knew it would be and the negatives. We knew it would be the negative, by the way. There is no direct flight to either coast. I don't understand. Everything here, we have, like, a phenomenal business, outstanding intelligentsia, like, great working class, all this stuff. Like, and where's the airport? Anyway, okay. That's my rant. City councilors.
But you have to admit that getting through any of the Iowa airports is like a dream come true compared to...
Totally
other
agree.
Major
totally
airports.
Agree. I understand.
It's just that you then have to transfer in one of those other airports.
I totally agree. I'm just, if I'm going to go negative at all on the air, that's all I got.
I remember waddling on the tarmac to get on the plane to come here from wherever our intermediary city was, and being like, I had like a flash moment of like, oh my God, what are we doing? And then stepping in the plane and sitting down and being like, oh my God. What are we doing? This is so cool.
Oh, yeah. No, we brought a pregnant lady with small children, like immigrants, into Iowa, and we're welcomed.
Yeah, we really were.
I was watching some of your videos to prepare for this conversation today, and I was really struck. And most of the videos have puppets, which are very cool, or animation, which is very cool. And, I mean, they're really beautiful. They're really well done. And then I watched the video for No Trouble, which we heard earlier. And that is all family pictures and family videos, and you see that time. I mean, you talk about waddling. You were very pregnant. It's true. Beautiful,
so
beautiful, and
for
very
those who
pregnant.
Can't see Deb Towne is tiny,
she
teeny,
is
teeny, tiny.
Tiny
and when
woman.
She gets pregnant, there are four of her. So it was crazy. And then she shrinks down.
Thank goodness.
But then we also see these pictures of you going through your cancer treatment, losing your hair, playing with your beautiful children, and, you know, obviously going through so much physically. Now, in your music, I get the impression that you really bare your souls a lot. But to put those pictures out there, I mean, that seems very raw, very vulnerable to me. Why did you decide to do it?
I think it's for a similar reason why we put the songs out that we write. It feels like the more personal we get, the more universal, you know, the experiences, we get so much feedback about from the most personal things that we put out. It feels like, me too. I feel that too. And, so I think that, you know, I haven't been able to look back at that video very much. But it feels like, you know, we connected with so many people who were giving us support during my treatment, but also saying, yeah, I've had this experience. My mom, my sister, me, you know, and just it felt like, you know, these roots went out, just connecting all of us. And so in that way, it was vulnerable, but it also felt so deeply connected to other people as soon as it went out. You know, we just got so much feedback right away that was really positive.
We made a decision early on, because when you get something like this, you can either make it public or not make it public.
Yeah.
And Deb decided that she would rather err on the side of community if she could. And that was just a very natural progression from that.
Yeah, that's well described.
As you are performing these shows, and now, I mean, it's obvious why you haven't performed very much in recent years. You've been going through a lot. And just having three small children is a lot.
It is.
add to that so many other things, and that's even more. As you are playing these shows and being face-to-face with your fans, maybe for the first time in a long time, how does that feel at this point in your life?
The best.
Yeah, it feels great.
The best. Good. I don't know if you want to expand.
Yeah. I don't know. I think partly also because we've been putting out songs for a while that people have been taking into their lives, you know, and I felt like when we did a few shows over the summer, like we saw some faces of people who we've seen before, you know, like 10 years ago, and they feel like there's such a powerful connection. And then, you know, and people we've never met but who have been listening to us for a long time and feel like they know us. That can be strange, but it can also feel real in a way. They do kind of know us because we put these songs out that are very, you know, much
personal.
Well, very personal, yeah.
The last tour, so we went on tour last year with 15 crew members and band members in a bus, and it was so fun. We had the drummer from Elvis Costello's band, and we had the music director from Sarah Bareilles' Waitress, and it was like this insane band, and it was great, and bigger theaters, and a little bit numbing to the audience for the connection, for me.
It created some distance.
Yeah, a little bit.
I think so. And it wasn't bad. I think it was good. But we had trouble when we came home. We landed weird, and we thought, boy, that wasn't connective. So then we played some shows. We're like, well, what if we just got up there with our guitars? No text, no nothing. We'll just drive up in our minivan and do it. And we did. And I've never had so much fun. We did it this summer. We did it down in Florida where we'd never played. And we thought, let's do a couple more. But that turned into 18. So now we're doing 18. But
well, and you're both working on solo stuff, and we're out of time. But I hope you'll come back and talk to us when your solo projects come out. And
absolutely.
Oh, I just heard most of Deb Talent's solo record. I'm very excited for you, me, and all of us.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thanks, Charity. Thanks for having us.
Deb Talent and Steve Tannen, they are the Weepies. They will be playing at the Englert in Iowa City on Saturday, November 26th at 8 p.m., completely acoustic and alone. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
'Cause I know which side you're on, and it's not mine.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Lorenzo Sandoval is the artistic director and executive producer of the Iowa Shakespeare Experience. He's also a member of one of the oldest clubs in Des Moines. It's called the Prairie Club. And a presentation he did at that club is what led to this conversation today. We're going to talk about growing up Hispanic in the Quad Cities and what it means to be other. Lorenzo, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. Certainly appreciate it.
Well, and I just mentioned the Prairie Club. And it, honestly, it's a club I hadn't heard of before this conversation. So for those of us who don't know about one of the oldest clubs in Des Moines, what is this group?
Well, I helped found it 125 years ago. No, actually, it's been around for about 125 years. We had a huge celebration recently, and it is one of the oldest clubs in which founded by individuals who wanted to get together regularly, it turns out for us monthly, to present an issues-oriented paper, something that would incite some kinds of discussion. It has had a very colorful history because some of the people would be involved in very heated discussions. As time has gone on, we've established some wonderful traditions there. We still continue with presenting great papers, issues-oriented papers. We get very, very thoughtful reflections from the other members when we're done presenting. We're very respectful about that. But everyone really, really seems animated. I've noticed this in the years that I've been a member there. Seems animated by the end of the evening because we've been given something, these thoughts to really, really think about, very powerful thoughts from our friends who are members of this club.
And I've read that you, in 2005, when you joined the club, you became the first minority member of this club. And 2005 seems a little late for that.
Yes. In fact, well, it's notable, too, when women were allowed to be in members of the club. And then that was a while back. But I think also if you were to look at it and take a, you know, zoom back, you would think as well, yeah, that was a little late to have women involved and possibly a little late, as you say, for a minority person to be involved. But it has happened. I'm really grateful that I'm in there. I certainly don't let me state it affirmatively. I've enjoyed the time that I've been there, and in fact, we've had more minorities, more women involved in the club. And again, it just seems to be a wonderful magnet for these great ideas that are presented, shared, and people respond to them so very well. And then, of course, we hope that those ideas will go out into the community and have a life as well.
Well, and that's what has happened with the presentation that you gave. You just following your presentation with the Prairie Club and the publication of your paper for that club, you were also invited to give a presentation as part of the Iowa International Center and their Dialogues program sponsored by Meredith Corporation. So let's talk about what you chose to write about, because you did grow up in a Hispanic family in the Quad Cities. You've been living in Des Moines since 1977. So give us a little bit of a frame of reference. When were you growing up in the Quad Cities?
I would have been growing up in the 1950s. In fact, I was recently part of a program where I was telling people about my background in that my grandparents on both sides, matriarch and patriarchal sides, they came up to the Quad Cities roughly around the same time in the early 1900s. They were escaping the terror and the chaos of the Mexican Revolution. It was horrible. So they finally settled in the Midwest, and specifically the Quad Cities. The Martinez is on one side, the Sandovales on the other side of the Mississippi River. And ultimately, there were children, and my parents were born here. Ultimately, I was born here. And one of the main attractions for those families, our families in particular, to the Quad Cities were the work in the foundries and work on the railroads. I remember talking to an older gentleman several years ago, and he talked, oh, the smokestacks. He says, if you saw smokestacks in a city, you knew there would be jobs. So I can just imagine what my grandparents must have gone through when they saw those smokestacks, so to speak, and, of course, the railroads. They're a big part of my history. But one of the things I guess I wanted to stress was that my folks, or my grandparents, and they instilled this in my parents, was there was this thing about really wanting to acclimate. They wanted to keep some important aspects of the culture intact, and that would be the Mexican culture. They wanted to keep that intact, for sure. But as I grew up, it was very important for me to really know English very, very well, to understand the prevailing values of the time, to just really, really fit in, always fit in. And there was nothing negative about my saying that. So I'm saying that contrary to maybe some opinions where people feel like, oh, they never want to acclimate, they never want to settle or anything. But in those days, really, I mean, my name was anglicized at the time. This may shock a few people, but in my formative years, I was Larry Sandoval. Larry Sandoval, although my birth certificate said Lorenzo Luis Sandoval. That was the name I was given. And ultimately, I adopted my own name, if you will, for various reasons.
When you were growing up, you know, you were just a kid growing up in the Quad Cities and doing what kids do and going to school. And did you feel like you were other? Did you feel like you weren't like the other kids?
No, I didn't feel different. In my paper, I did talk about, I did have an instance. There was an incident, and that really put something, it layered a dimension on me that I haven't been able to escape since. My friends and I were wanting to go swimming when we were teenagers, and we went to a private club, one of my friends, a swimming club, country club, if you will. One of my friends, his father was a member there, so we all went. We're just all looking forward to the experience, talking about the dives that we were going to make and everything, and I was rejected at the door. There was no explanation given. All my friends could go in. The non-members could go in, but I couldn't go in. And the guy just simply said at the door, he just can't. He just can't. When he was pressed about it, can't let him. It can't let him.
Did you immediately understand why you were singled out?
Yes, I did. And it was very sad. And I want to say that my friends were kind of angels that day. It kind of makes me choke up a little bit, but they were kind of angels that day because they at least wanted to know why. I could tell that they were disconcerted, a little angry, and they would dedicate dives to me while I was on the outside. And I said, no, you guys go ahead. You swim. I'll just watch you.
So you just stood outside the fence.
And I just sat outside the fence, and I just watched them do these dives that they would dedicate to me. I dedicate this dive to you, Mr. Sandoval, and all that. And that was very nice. That was the salve on that wound that day. And so that's when, and I can't say that's the first time I realized it, but I guess I realized the ugly aspect of being an other. One of the things that I've also mentioned is that, like W.E.B. Du Bois says in his books, is that sometimes we can otherize ourselves, and that is by acquiring a second set of eyes, a second pair of eyes, and usually of the, well, the empowered population. And I got that second pair of eyes early on from my mother in particular, who would say, you know, she would admonish me when I would go out for the evening or something as a kid. Now, remember, don't talk too loud, mind your manners, don't ask for seconds. I always remember that. Don't ask for seconds. You want to behave well because you don't want anybody thinking bad about us because we're Mexican.
So she made you feel like you were an ambassador for your people.
Isn't that interesting? But yes, in a way, yes. An ambassador, a young ambassador, exactly.
So let's bring this conversation to the present. I mean, you are as Iowan as any one of us, or maybe more. And you've had a long and successful career. And returning to thinking about your childhood and exploring this idea of what it means to be other, and looking around yourself in Des Moines of 2016, in Iowa of 2016, what do you see? What do you think is important for all of us to see?
Well, there's been a lot of, well, in with the recent days, the elections and all that, there's been a lot of talk about divisions. And I think about those divisions a lot. I thought, well, these are a long time in the making. They really are. Divisions between cultures, divisions between economic classes, genders. And it just seems like everything really, really has hit very harshly right now under the spotlight, these differences. And I've been thinking for years about how to bridge those differences. But first, I thought, in order for me to even think about bridging differences, maybe I needed to understand the nature of differences. And so I just naturally drifted to literature that dealt with the other. And the other, just simply that, you could say, that primal split, that differentiation that we're all aware of. There's I and thou. There's me and you. That already is that can portend to be a great divide in our life experiences. And so I think about that nature, and then I think, well, what evolves from that? And again, there's been a lot of literature written about that. But I've got to kind of boil down to when we confront the other, we can make choices, we can accept, deal with, work with that other. Another choice would be, I'm going to stay away. I'm going to choose not to work with that individual or be around them. A third choice, an unfortunate choice, is I'm going to do away with that other, with that individual. And there, of course, is violence. You can do it, the violence, in a variety of ways. And one of them is just keeping them out of the neighborhoods and then, of course, insulting that particular group, assigning them stereotypes and things like that, or, of course, doing great bodily harm and to eliminate the other. Those are some very interesting choices there. And so through my work in theater, that has also given me a platform for understanding the other, the various experiences that go on with that. And, you know, Charity, it's, of course, very, very complex. I've had friends who have well-intentioned friends, artistic friends, who at grad school, for example, I was at a playwrights workshop at Iowa. By the way, that's a great program there. So it's nothing about the program. It was just some of the colleagues that I was with who would say, gosh, you ought to write what you know. Write about your Latino-ness. Put that up on the stage. I said, well, I'm kind of a complex guy here. I was born in the Midwest. I've been raised in the Midwest. I haven't lived outside of the Midwest at all. The furthest away I've ever been is I lived in the Twin Cities for a while. I said, and I got to tell you, not all of my experiences have been what you would probably consider Latino. I had written a play called Country Western Love at Chuck's Bar and Grill, which had nothing to do whatsoever with Latino-ness, and I was questioned about that. And I said, well, wait a minute. I know that experience. As a young man, I made those choices. I lived in that milieu. I understood all that country western heartbreak and the value system that went with that.
But at the same time, the people who were saying that to you, mm-hmm. probably, I'm guessing this may not be the case, but they probably meant well, were maybe really excited about having a Latino voice that they could support. And do you feel like sometimes even with the people with the best of intentions reinforce that otherness?
Yes, and I did want to underscore that. They were well-intentioned. And I like what you said there. They were excited for me. And they thought that by me having – well, that I should take advantage of the freedom, so to speak, that I had on that campus to really put that out there and show it to the cosmos, if you will, the Latino experience. Once again, I would be ambassador for the Latinos. But and so I appreciated that. And ultimately, I did write several plays about my particular Latino experiences, if you will. But I don't want to think that anything else that I write or anything else that I do, if it's not Latino, means that I'm less than a Latino even. There's otherizing even within our own population as well. You know, I'm artistic director with the Iowa Shakespeare Experience, and I try to put on bold interpretations of Shakespeare. Several years ago, we did Othello, and I decided to set Othello in the 1860s Mexico. I wanted to model Othello on Benito Juarez, the first Mexican Indian president who had suffered all kinds of discrimination, but ultimately he made it to the ultimate of power, if you will, the presidency of Mexico. And I wanted to show the same thing happening in the life of Othello, where he experienced all of these horrible accusations and stereotypes, the worst types of stereotypes, and his life endangered as he was rising to the top, doing what he knew how to do best, which was, of course, be a general and wage war. And so the setting to me was very appropriate. And some people, when they saw that, where I made Othello a Mexican Indian, some people understood that, what I was trying to do. Actually, I was trying to put the Latino voice in there. But others would sometimes ask, is that Shakespeare? What? So, and I think Shakespeare, and then I drift to him because he is so complex. He's peopled it with some of the richest, and I mean personalities, richest characters. To me, he also has given us an invitation to play with him, to talk with him, to have a living dialogue with him. And me and my Latino-ness, that's what I do.
So you were given this second set of eyes growing up and made aware of your otherness, but also able to see maybe in some ways that some other people can't, how otherness is reinforced or created in our culture. And in giving this speech and in delivering this paper right now at this time, at a time when, at least in my lifetime, the country seems to be more divided than ever before, what did you learn from this? What did you take away from it quickly?
I'm going to say that I learned that, first of all, it's good to have an honest dialogue. It's going to be messy. Let's reach out, embrace the differences, if anything. Love me because I'm the same as you. Love me because I'm different from you. That's what I've learned. That's what I want to pass on.
Lorenzo Sandoval, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Charity. I really, really appreciated the invitation. Thank you.
Lorenzo Sandoval is the artistic director and executive producer of the Iowa Shakespeare Experience. He gave a presentation about what it's like to be other and what otherness means to the Prairie Club of Des Moines.